My name is Paul LaChapelle. I'm a professor in political science, and I'm funded through Extension. I'm the community development specialist working across the state. I'm going to let my colleagues introduce themselves when they speak in this order, and we're going alphabetically, Bozeman, Missoula, and Whitefish. So you'll hear about those three communities and the resiliency planning that they've actually have been engaged in and are moving forward on. So. Just, I'll talk to you briefly about some of the work that I'm doing. For the last 6 years or so, I've been involved in climate outreach work as part of my Extension appointment. And one of those projects has been this 4-H Weather and Climate Youth Learning Lab. And we got funding from the USDA Climate Hub office that's based in Fort Collins to develop this this learning lab. We worked with partners in four states, and this has now been accepted as a national 4-H curriculum for grades 3 through 5. So we're really excited about that, and that this will be available free of charge for youth across the country. And I'll be speaking tomorrow, as a matter of fact, at the Montana Science Teachers Association annual meeting to try to engage science teachers to incorporate this these materials into their curricula as well. Also just recently published earlier this year this edited book, 18 chapters with 42 authors, contributing authors, with my colleague Don Albrecht from Utah State University. So it's available on Routledge. Look for it on Amazon. So I won't go into too much detail, but there's been a tremendous amount of information out there about the impacts on specifically on communities of place we'll talk about right now, and the challenges that they'll face in the coming decades. The U.S. Global Change Research Program states that this issue will challenge the ability of society and natural systems to adapt. Diseases and conditions will worsen, according to NIH. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that vulnerable areas and the poor, young, old, and sick are going to be the most susceptible. Oxfam says that the impacts are going to be overwhelmingly negative. And the Stern Review, which many see as one of the most comprehensive assessments of the economics of climate change, says similarly that the poorest countries and people will suffer earliest and most. Again, lots of data out there. This from the National Climate Assessment in 2014, looking at all those vulnerable populations from the aging populations across the United States and here in Montana, to increasing asthma rates, chronic respiratory disease deaths, obesity rates, diagnosed diabetes, and poverty. All of these populations now are more susceptible, more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. We've seen information coming out from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, talking about the impacts as well, and they've got a ton of information available about from allergens to vectors to air pollution to extreme heat and what those impacts are going to look like and what the responses potentially could be. So as a result of these potential impacts and facing communities, a number of us got together, and you'll hear from my colleagues in just a minute, to form this very informal group now, Climate Smart Montana, kind of based on the name that was started in Missoula, which you'll hear about in just a minute, Climate Smart Missoula. But we formed this. You can see the website, and you can see who all the partners are that are involved in this at the top of the screen. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit network with the goal of sharing information and resources to better coordinate community-based climate solutions and resiliency efforts in Montana. So we're just trying to collect and distribute the most relevant climate science materials. We're sharing best practices and highlighting success stories. We're just trying to understand local challenges, facilitating community efforts, identifying and obtaining funds, and hopefully encouraging other communities to think about this and act. So now you're going to hear from individuals in these three communities that I mentioned and hear about those resiliency planning efforts in more detail. So I'll introduce my colleague, Natalie Meyer, who's the Sustainability Program Manager with the City of Bozeman. And I'll advance the slides for you if you like.
That sounds great. Well, it's an honor to be here. And thank you, Paul, for organizing Climate Smart Montana and organizing this workshop. I'm with the City of Bozeman. I've been in this role since 2008. And in that time, we've developed a number of guiding policy documents that really started with our internal operations. In 2008, we adopted a mitigation plan that looks at things like fire, police department operations, water, sewer, all of our internal operations and buildings. Then in 2011, we really turned to the community and partnered with organizations like MSU and developed a community-wide mitigation plan. How can we reduce emissions? This plan lays out a target for the city of Bozeman of reducing emissions 10% below 2008 levels by 2025. And this was one of the earlier plans around the country, and we've been working with it, but we'll talk more about what we're doing next. Then after 2017, NOAA declared it to be the costliest year on record for natural disasters. We got a little bit more serious about adaptation and resiliency. We started again with internal operations and focused inward on what the city needs to do to prepare for climate change. That plan was completed in 2019. So we've been hard at work for a number of years. Here's just a few statistics that kind of indicate what we've been doing. We've focused a lot on municipal energy efficiency and conservation, saving minimally, these are verified savings, of $371,000. And to put that in terms everyone understands, that's 538 Subaru Foresters driving around for a year. We also have a business energy project where we partner with local small businesses primarily and help them through the energy audit process and also provide the additional incentive of up to $2,500. And through that program, businesses around town are saving about $54,000 a year, or equivalent to planting about 6,100 urban forest trees planted for 10 years. We also have a number of solar PV installations around town, the most significant being the 385-kilowatt solar array located at our water reclamation facility, but funded by Northwestern Energy through a kind of unique partnership. That's generated 1,300 megawatt hours of electricity, or equivalent to burning 13 tankers of gasoline. So this is the breakdown of Bozeman's greenhouse gas emissions. The primary sources for us are buildings. Commercial buildings make up 30%, residential buildings 23%, and then the other big chunk is vehicle transportation. And we'll talk about that more in a moment. Our share of aviation at the Bozeman Airport is about 7%, and landfill waste is 5%, and our water and wastewater treatment processes are, you know, 0.2%. I'll spend a little more time on this somewhat involved slide. This is a snapshot from 2012 to 2016, just helping us identify the trends. Overall, in that period, we reduced emissions by 5%. While population growth increased by 20%, job growth in the county increased by 22%. We saw that home energy use per person went down 7%, residential emissions went down 16%, commercial emissions from buildings, those went down 9% per job, and overall 25%. The things underlying that, what's driving those reductions, are primarily the transition from Northwestern Energy's electricity portfolio, transitioning from coal to hydroelectricity. It also, we saw a bump with the new adopted state energy code, and also the installation of LED lighting is driving that change. In transportation, this is where we have more problems. Emissions went up 7% per person, meaning that more people are driving on our roads from out of town. Transportation emissions overall went up 26%, and waste emissions went up 8%. And then introducing the resiliency piece, we know from the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment, this is a very general paraphrasing, but we expect more days over 90 degrees, more urban flood events in Bozeman, longer and more intense drought in an already drought-prone area, reduced mountain snowpack, which makes up most of Bozeman's water supply, and of course more severe wildfire and more severe winter storms, which we as an organization are definitely feeling already. With that in mind, we partnered with some pretty fantastic organizations like NIST and MSU Extension and Gallatin County Emergency Management, and we looked at things like our hazard mitigation plan, our continuity of operations planning procedures, and we sat down with staff, had extensive interviews, workshops, tabletops, and we figured out what do we need to do to better prepare. And MSU is part of that continuity of operations planning. We've developed a framework for resiliency through that plan, but the big part of it is that we recognize that we have a role to play in educating and informing the public. This plan's new, so I can't talk about great successes, but these are the types of policies that you'll find in the plan. It's about building out backup generation, increasing redundancies, increasing air filtration capabilities in key critical buildings in anticipation of more smoky days. For policy, getting a little bit more aggressive with water conservation in new developments, and also updating our stormwater standards to better handle urban flooding. One step that the city's taken in recent years, after the U.S. withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement, then-mayor signed on to the 2017 Compact of Mayors. And we're taking this commitment pretty seriously. And as we update our climate plan, we have our eyes on this and how we can meet or exceed this expectation. So this is kind of another breakdown of our emissions from 2008 to 2012 to 2016. Our baseline year was 2008. And from that time, we essentially saw no increase in emissions. And this blue wedge represents what emissions would look like in a business as usual scenario. So we're doing better than that. But this smaller blue wedge represents what we would have to do under the Paris Climate Agreement. And that's just accepting 2 degrees of warming. So we know that we need to go further than that. So a lot of work to do in a town that has grown 26% since 2008. And we are reducing on a per capita basis. From that time, we reduced emissions 22% per person. So that's what we're up against right now. And as we go ahead, look to update our new climate plan, it will be more comprehensive, and that'll include both municipal and community emissions. But we're also have an eye towards community resiliency and integrating the conversations we've already had, but bringing it to the broader community. Another piece we're really focused on at this plan is climate equity and human health and well-being. We're working really hard to come up with a diverse group of stakeholders to help us walk through that process.
Thanks, Natalie. We'll turn now to Missoula. Amy Sillenberg is with Climate Smart Missoula, and we'll maybe just take a second to get her on the line.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm sorry that I'm not there in person. It's great to follow the work of Natalie and Bozeman. It's real inspiration what you folks are doing there. So I'm going to share with you today some of Missoula's efforts to create a climate resilient community. And you can hit the next. So just a quick background, Climate Smart Missoula is a pretty new local organization. We're a nonprofit, we're about 4 years old. The three women in the picture below our logo are the staff, and we work with a lot of partners. This is a picture of us with runs the Montana Renewable Energy Association. So we partner with a lot of other nonprofits, and also we work very closely with local government, both the city of Missoula and Missoula County. And next. And our mission is to engage our community in climate actions, catalyzing efforts to reduce our carbon footprint and build a resilient Missoula. So we do work at Climate Smart on both mitigation and adaptation efforts. So the mitigation, you know, reducing our carbon footprint, we measure our greenhouse gas emissions here in Missoula at the community level in particular, and work to reduce those. Just real quick, we were kind of lead authors and worked with local government to create this options report for how Missoula would transition to 100% electricity last fall. And then over the course of last winter, both the city and the county passed resolutions to adopt 100% clean electricity goal by 2030. And we're sort of strong partners in that and trying to work out right now a roadmap and figure out how we actually do that, working with utility and co-ops and a whole bunch of other green building efforts and things. But in the context of today's talk, I thought I'd share a little bit more about our adaptation efforts. I'm happy to answer more questions about the mitigation at any point after, at the end of our presentations or offline. But we could talk a little bit more about adaptation work that's kind of crucial to how Climate Smart got started. So again, we're about 4 years old, and when we first started, we basically came to be because a bunch of folks in the community pulled together a community climate action plan. And one of the buckets or focal areas was a healthy Missoula. And we recognized that nobody in our community was really thinking strongly about how we kind of address some of the changing conditions. So this is a 2015 photo. If you're familiar with Missoula, that's Mount Sentinel and where that arrow is pointing to the M, which you can't even see because of wildfire smoke. Really our strategy, but the health department would put out alerts about poor air quality, but our strategy amongst the community was really, pray for rain or leave town when the smoke got bad. And we recognized that with changing conditions due to climate, heat and wildfire smoke in particular, we needed to be doing more. So we got together, got some funding together and started a program that we ended up calling Summer Smart. We started this initiative to figure out, how could we better prepare ourselves for changing summer conditions. And on our website, if you dig around, there's just a whole bunch of resources. So we created resources, we did outreach, education, workshops, and really thought hard about how we could get folks to think about planting trees for hotter days and shade and, addressing some of the health risks that come with heat and also, again, focusing pretty heavily on the wildfire smoke and developing some resources to help people understand what to do. At this point, one of the things we worked with our health department really thinking about, the message that we have for folks when it is smoky is to go inside. And we did some preliminary monitoring and realized that in really smoky conditions, inside air quality can be just as bad as the outdoor air quality. And we recognize that there's a lot of people that are particularly vulnerable to wildfire smoke. What we did, we started a program in 2017 to provide HEPA portable air cleaners to clean the indoor air of some of the folks the most vulnerable. So the top couple pictures are some volunteers that were helping to deliver HEPA air filters to folks that were referred to us by Meals on Wheels. The low-income, homebound seniors with respiratory issues are particularly vulnerable. A lot of them live in sort of leaky homes, have poor air quality. And so we started a program to just give those to these folks so that they could breathe easier. This was in the beginning of 2017 when everybody said, oh, it's going to be a great summer. We don't really expect a lot of wildfire smoke. And then we were hit with what the scientists now call a flash drought. It got hot. It got really dry, and that's the summer where we had the big fire on Sealy Lake in Lolo, and air quality was really dangerous. We ended up switching gears because we had this program up and running. We just started buying more air filters everywhere we could get them and giving them to both schools and also just individuals that were in desperate need. So because we were thinking about climate change and we were trying to think about adaptation strategies, we had this program going, and we really just were able to run with it when folks were really in need. And it worked pretty well. So it's just really an example of what you can do if you're thinking ahead a little bit and partnering, in our case, with our health department. On the lower, there's a couple of pictures of babies and kids. We've expanded that program over the last couple of years to give these air filters to daycares because they have a lot of children are extremely vulnerable, and you get a lot of babies in one place, you might as well have clean air. So we continue to work on ways to prepare our community for these changing conditions with this Summer Smart program. And, the idea with this particular program, it was, you know, really focused on some of the things that we at Climate Smart could do. And as we started to bring those forward, we realized that our, you know, wildfire smoke and heat are just a small few of the components, and we really need to grow our efforts to be more adapted to the changes that we're seeing. So we sat down with worked with the city of Missoula and Missoula County to develop and implement specific strategies to build local climate resilience. And thinking not just the city of Missoula, but our whole county, which if folks know, Missoula is pretty big. Next slide. And when we got together, this is myself and Chase Jones and Diana Minetta, so two other individuals that work in local government. We became familiar with Climate Ready Communities. It's a program it's a whole program that's out there that folks can tap into. And what's pretty neat about it is they offer tools and a guidebook that are specific to smaller communities. You know, you can read a lot about developing resiliency strategies for Boston and San Francisco and big communities with both money and also different issues that we may have. This Climate Ready Communities is a guidebook that's kind of designed for folks, for communities around the size of Missoula or even smaller. In the middle there, you can see there's that picture in the middle is actually the guidebook, and you can get that for free if anybody's interested in looking through this. So it's a very detailed look at what a community can do, and they take you through and step you through the process. So we sort of joined on to using this as our process moving forward. Next slide. And what we are going through, and I bring this up because it's an ongoing process right now, and so the process that we're using, and again, I'm working really closely with the city of Missoula and with Missoula County, and it's about a 20-month process that we're working on. We started in the summer of 2018. We convened a steering committee with both community members, but also with a lot of folks that work in local government, and we created a climate and community primer, and I'll talk about these briefly. These next couple stages briefly as I go forward. We identify and prioritize vulnerabilities, who and what's at risk. And then we're right now in step four, develop and prioritize adaptation strategies. And then once we have those, that works into a resiliency plan, and then we work to implement the plan. That's the big piece that we'll be getting to in 2020. That's kind of our overarching process. And when we got into this, we wanted to look very closely at what the scientists were telling us that were projections for Missoula County. So we worked with a bunch of scientists at UM, especially from the Montana Climate Assessment and the National Climate Assessment. And we really explained, I think our primer is like 88 pages of real detailed look at what is expected to happen. And one thing we did with this, just to help folks get their heads around what kinds of changes we might expect to see, is we came up with some different scenarios, plausible explanations of a future. And they're very different because we don't know what the future is going to hold. So this whole process we're going into, we're looking at it with, you know, we just don't know where we're headed. But these are some plausible futures. One is turn up the heat where it's hotter and drier. Another scenario that would have different implications for our community and for our county would be here comes the rain again, where it's a lot wetter, especially in the shoulder seasons. And then feast or famine, which is the idea that every year is going to be really different, even if the overall trend might be for hotter and drier in the summer, wetter around the shoulder seasons, we're going to have a lot of variation. And how do we as a community think about that and plan strategies? So that's all in our primer that we pulled together, and it was very useful to setting this up for the next stage. Forward, next. I guess I'll mention there that last scenario where the feast or famine, it's just really difficult and something to be aware of if you're doing adaptation planning. You know, you start to plan for some of the changes you expect to see, and then you have a nice summer and it's not smoky, and people forget what's happening, and you have to help the community understand that we're really thinking for the future. Clear skies or foggy skies, you're going to get both of them. So the first thing that, once we had that primer, we had a big community workshop of over 100 people, and we brought them together and really worked in cross-sector conversations around thinking about who and what is most at risk given these climate projections and these scenarios. So this was really developing our vulnerability assessment and understanding what's at risk. So we pulled a lot of people together. It was a really useful and very helpful workshop, although we came out of it being a little stunned because there's a lot of risks and there's a lot of, especially people vulnerable. And what we did was we looked at about 9 different sectors, and we actually dug into who and what's at risk in these different sectors. And you can see those, everything from agriculture, aquatic systems, buildings, business, recreation, and tourism. How will all these be affected down the line? And we had some small group conversations in each of those and tried to, again, understand the vulnerabilities and the risks involved there. We also had a group that looked at cultural considerations and social equity, and we started that as sort of a sector, and then really that became something larger than just one of these individual sectors, and we used that as some of our guiding principles. So we pulled all this stuff together. We have now a vulnerability assessment to understand again, who and what's at risk. And we, next slide. We brought that out to the community. One of the ways we looked at it was trying to understand how hard it is to respond to the risks that climate change brings and what are the biggest problems. And we developed these grids for each of those sectors that were on the previous slide. And, you know, basically filled in the grid. I wasn't going to show you all the words there, but it's all in our vulnerability assessment that you can get online. We brought those out, and we brought that to the community. So we tried to get a lot of community input, not just from our steering committee and the workshop, but also just some open houses and things, so people could tell us what did we get wrong and what did we miss. And this is just an example of that. And then we've taken all that, and actually we adjusted our vulnerability assessment, and then we used that to kind of seed our second workshop, which was where we brought another group, mostly the same people, but some new folks, another 100 or so folks together for a workshop where we figured out or started to look into what kind of actions and activities we would need to do to actually solve for these risks that we identified. So what are the solutions that will help us be a more resilient community? And that's just some photos from that event, which was last May. And then we've taken all of that information and we've tried to figure out to actually organize those. From that workshop, we had over 300 different activities or actions that people identified as things we could do in our community and in our county that would make us more resilient to climate change. Everything from, again, those HEPA air filters, making those more available to folks, to planting trees, helping our urban forest grow, and, you know, dealing with the heat island effect that you might see in the summertime. So we're working through that now. This is, again, a program that's a planning process that's happening, and we've gotten over 300 of our actions down to about 88 that we're looking to prioritize those and, again, bring those out to the community, get public input, figure out what we've missed, and try to bring that back, because that will be the bulk of our climate adaptation plan. So the idea is to take this plan that we're developing together with the primer that explains the science, the vulnerability assessment that explains who and what's at risk, and then these proposed solutions, bring that all together with the implementation task force and really integrate it into all the other work that happens both within local government but also within businesses and nonprofits and some of the other key entities within Missoula and our county. So that's our plan, and we should have that done by early 2020. You know, I think what Missoula is trying to do is a kind of a combination of some things that we've identified need to happen. We're just doing them. We've got our planting trees. We're trying to think about wildfire smoke, thinking about the health and climate risk. And then we're also trying to plan for much longer, trying to look out towards mid-century and think about what it is that we need to do. This is our overall timeline. This is available on our website right now. It's you can go to MissoulaClimate.org and find it pretty readily, the whole process. And we'll be developing a website just for this resiliency planning effort. But you can see there's lots of stages, lots of steps, lots of value in reaching out to the community and getting buy-in for this work. But we think it's been a really valuable process so far. We're looking forward to what we actually figure out to do, prioritizing our actions. Yeah, okay, that's my last slide. And again, I'm happy to talk more at the end or at a future date with any folks that are interested in more planning.
That's great. Thanks, Amy. Now we'll go up north to Whitefish, and Kate should be on the line.
Hi, my name is Kate McMahon. I am a planning consultant, and I live in Whitefish. I work with communities all around the state on a variety of planning issues. But as a resident of Whitefish, I was appointed as a community volunteer to the city's Climate Action Committee to help develop Whitefish's first climate action. And I'm also a board member for a nonprofit up here, Climate Smart Glacier Country, and so I'm going to be talking about both of those today. And I'd like to thank you for inviting us to participate. Bozeman and Missoula are sort of hard acts to follow. We're relatively new to this, but I'm going to give you an idea about what we've been doing in Whitefish. I'm going to be talking about the process to develop the plan, what some of the content recommendations are, and then some of the accomplishments that have happened in the years since we have adopted the plan. The process that we used to develop this plan was actually involved a partnership with the school district and with the nonprofit Climate Smart Glacier Country. So Climate Smart Glacier Country was very active in helping to write the plan. And then there is a chapter with the Whitefish School District, which also looks at their operation. Whitefish School District received a donation a few years ago to build a sustainability center to offer curriculum to the high school, elementary, middle schools on sustainability. So they had just received that funding. They were in the process of developing that center, and so they were a major partner in this as well. In January 2017, the City Council passed a resolution to appoint the committee and charge them with drafting this plan. Soon thereafter, the United States drew from the Paris Climate Agreement, and it was mentioned in the Bozeman presentation, 391 mayors from around the country agreed to uphold that agreement, and Whitefish was one of the communities, Mayor Mulfield from Whitefish. The first step was to develop a greenhouse gas emission. I'll go over that in another slide. But I also want to say that this process was community involvement was very important to that. It included a survey, a number of forums, public hearings, news medias, happy hours. We just tried a lot of different ways to engage the community so this would reflect their vision and not just the committee's vision. So the City of Whitefish, our first step was to develop a greenhouse gas emission. This inventory was only for city operations. We did not attempt to do a community-wide inventory at this point. That might be something that we would do in the future, but just to start out, we focused on city operations. That was our charge from City Council. We had an Energy Corps intern from NCAT in Butte that was here in Whitefish, and she helped go through all the utility bills from years past to put this together. And as you can see, as far as the city's operations, the biggest user or biggest greenhouse gas emission is our water and wastewater treatment systems, you know, falling by buildings and then vehicle use. So after we did the greenhouse gas emission and developed that sort of baseline data, we started drafting the report. We had subcommittees within the committee that worked on different sections of the report. So I'm going to go through each section here. And one of the key sections is forest and watersheds, which, again, the report was focused on reducing greenhouse emissions, but we also realized that adaptation was going to be a big part of this. The entire city of Whitefish is in the wildland-urban interface. We are surrounded by Forest Service land, by state forest land, and by private forest land. So we have concerns with just being a fire-wise community. If the area up near the ski resort were to catch fire, the city would be at threat because the embers would actually blow down and our structures would be in that. So you saw the Paradise Fire in California was happening while we were in the process of adopting this plan. So as unfortunate as that was, it was a reminder that our community is at high risk, you know, from fires. So forests and watersheds was a key component of the plan. In addition to just becoming a fire-adapted community and trying to be proactive in avoiding fire in the Haskell Basin, a key strategy was to institute a conservation easement on private forest land that's directly north of the city. This was important for a couple reasons. The city's water supply comes from the watershed that is covered by Haskell Water Basin, so a forest fire would directly threaten our water supply. And we wanted to protect that water supply also from potential development, because it is private forest land, and so it could be sold off for development. So the city was able to purchase a conservation easement. The funding came from, not USGS, but USFS, US Forest Service provided a grant. The private landowner made a donation by reducing some of the cost for it. And then a good portion of the cost to purchase that conservation easement came from the city's resort tax because Whitefish meets the definition of a resort community. In state statutes, we can voluntarily impose a resort tax. We have had that tax in place for a number of years that has funded infrastructure. So the city had a voter initiative to increase that tax for the purpose of purchasing this conservation easement. That voter initiative passed. 80% of the community supported a self-imposed tax to purchase that conservation easement. So we were able to do that to protect the watershed. The conservation easement also negotiated, it's an active forest, a managed forest, so we were able to negotiate, some forest management provisions there. But as far as climate change, by protecting that area from future development, it sequesters, it's a carbon sink. So that became a huge strategy for us. And with that carbon sink, if we want to be a carbon neutral community, rather than just reducing our emissions, we don't have to buy offsets because we've purchased this conservation easement that will allow us to be carbon neutral community. So the next section that we worked on was transportation and land use. So this focused on the fleet management for the city. Converting to electric vehicles and driving practices to reduce the emissions from the city's fleet. But there was also a lot of focus on community-wide strategies that contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. A lot of that is coming from commuters. Whitefish has a good portion of the population that commutes to work from Kalispell and Columbia Falls. Our housing prices are higher here because we are a resort community. So a lot of the workforce lives in surrounding communities because it's more affordable, but then they commute. So having that commuting contributes a lot to greenhouse gas emissions. So the strategies are to address that was better public transportation, but also energy efficient workforce housing. If we can develop more workforce housing in the community, then that means there's going to be less people commuting. So workforce housing is actually a key component to our climate action plan. And so the city has a separate housing plan, and they're in the process right now of developing some new developments that will be deed restricted and be being permanently affordable. Some other strategies included green infrastructure, especially the urban forest, and I think Bozeman and Missoula both talked about planting trees and the benefits of doing that. Smart growth strategies such as walkability and reducing impervious surface, getting people out of cars, having less pavement, those types of things that I think are probably in the other place. So buildings and energy, if you recall on our greenhouse, that pie chart I had on emissions, that following water and wastewater, buildings and energy was the next highest operation that contributed to greenhouse gas emissions. So since we have done the plan, the city has converted most of its street lights to LED street lights, and that has actually had a big impact on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We have a brand new city hall, and our emergency operations center was built just 10 years ago. And even though these are newer buildings, we still have, they still had high energy usage. Part of that was because even when you design these buildings to LEED standards, which they're not LEED certified, but they use that as a guidance. If you don't have the monitoring and the using the correct software and certain operational practices, you're not going to realize those energy savings. So even though we have newer buildings that were designed with some energy efficient features, you have to continue. It's not just a one-off, oh, we built the building, now we're going to be fine. You have to continually monitor and audit those operations to make sure that you're actually realizing those energy savings. And then the city's water treatment plant, like I said, the city gets its water from Haskell, it's from the stream, Helmering Creek up in Haskell Basin. And as the city, as that water goes to the water treatment plant, the city years ago had installed a hydro plant to generate electricity to operate the treatment plant. And it had, for various reasons, stopped operating, and it was just sitting up there unused. So recently the city retrofitted that, started operating the hydro plant up at the water treatment plant, and it is now has paid for itself in 3 years. We're actually selling energy back to the grid, and it's a revenue generator. So it generates the electricity for the water treatment facility, as well as generates a revenue stream for the city. So water and wastewater, the city's in the process of designing a new wastewater facility, which, because we have to go through to a different type of treatment system, is actually going to be more of an energy consumer than the old facility. So to offset that, the old lagoons are going to be decommissioned, and we're talking about putting a community solar facility in the old water treatment lagoons to offset the energy use at the wastewater treatment plant. So that is one of the key things there. And also, because we have a lot of illegal sump pumps, a lot of the water that we were treating, which uses a lot of energy, was coming from illegal sump pump hookups. So we're doing a better job of enforcing that. So there's some strategies like that that you wouldn't normally think of that actually had some major impacts on the city. So the final section in the report was on consumption, food, and waste. If we promote local foods, we'll have less transportation, less packaging, less waste, less methane gas at the landfill, less consumption, less use of carbon intensive materials, especially plastics and things like that. So all of that was part of that as well. So since we adopted the plan, in 2018, the city made the Climate Action Committee a permanent committee to help implement the recommendations. They have worked with the U.S. Department of Energy to become a SoSmart designated community, which means we revised some of our land use codes to make it more feasible, and have done some training with the building inspectors to facilitate more use of solar. And on the transportation front, the city is going through a transit plan. They are building a transfer station by the railroad. We have Amtrak here so people can transfer from Amtrak to the city bus or to the snow bus that takes employees and skiers up to the mountain. The workforce housing projects, I've mentioned, city is currently working with somebody on food composting pickup site. We passed a water conservation ordinance this year, and we continue to do wildfire workshops to help make people more fire wise in their building practice. Climate Smart Glacier Country is the nonprofit that I'm also involved with that worked with the city on the plan. We've been in place since 2016. And we cover our service areas, all of Flathead County, so not just Whitefish. So we have representatives from Glacier National Park on the board, Flathead County Electric on the board, and we're really trying to have the education and activities throughout all of Flathead County and not just focused on Whitefish. If you can go to the next slide. The mission of the Climate Smart Glacier Country is mitigation, adaptation, and education, just trying to have the conversations on climate change in Flathead County and so that the other communities and other people that want to take action on that, we can be a resource to help them with that. What we do as a nonprofit, we partnered on the Whitefish Climate Plan. We hold a lot of workshops and seminars, community conversations. We try to be an information clearinghouse. We help organize Earth Day, do some grant writing, try to establish those partnerships. We work with Flathead County Health Department on a grant to deal with the impacts of wildfire smoke, which Missoula talked about a lot. And have given Climate Smart awards to businesses that are actually adopting sustainability practices. In November here, in a couple weeks, we're gonna be holding a symposium on plastics and how you can reduce your use of plastics. And this has become very important because due to China not taking plastic recyclables anymore, there is very limited plastic recycling in the Flathead, so there's a lot of interest in how we can reduce our use of plastics, and that is what that workshop will focus on. So thank you.
Thanks, Kate.